Good afternoon. I think I put this big enough I can read it without my glasses. When God finally had his conversation with Job at the end of the book of Job, he mentioned many aspects of creation with which Job was familiar. And I've talked about some of them before, but in doing so, he made a point of showing that there was a huge difference between being man and being God. And he's trying to bring that point home to Job. And in that, I was going to call it a conversation, but it wasn't. It was all only one-sided at this point. In Job 38 and verses 8 to 11, I'm going to read those verses here at the beginning of the sermon, Job 38, verses 8 to 11. And God asked Job this. Who enclosed the sea with doors? When bursting forth, it went out from the womb. When I made the cloud its garment and thick darkness its swaddling band. And I placed boundaries on it and set a bolt and doors. And I said, thus far you shall come, but no further or no farther. And here shall you, your proud waves stop. And you read that, and you say, okay, you know, God's making a point. He can do these things, and Job can't. What I want to draw your attention to are the things that God said he could do there. And it's going to set the tone for what I'm going to talk about today. He says he placed boundaries on the sea. When you think about that, that maybe doesn't make a whole lot of sense. You know, the sea goes up to the land, and it does make sense in a lot of ways, but we'll investigate those. I placed boundaries on it and set bolts and doors and said, thus far you shall come, but no farther, and your proud ways will stop here. In Proverbs 8, in Proverbs 8 and verse 29, wisdom is being personified throughout Proverbs 8, and it's talking about how long wisdom has been around. And of course, there's a lot of symbolism there that I won't get into. But in verse 29, it says, when he set for the sea its boundary so that the water would not transgress his command, when he marked out the foundations of the earth. Point being that wisdom has been around since then. But it's interesting what it says. It says he set for the sea its boundary. You know, the sea is got some kind of it's being hemmed in. So that the water would not transgress his command. In these two verses, and in many other locations, the Bible makes a point of stating that God has put boundaries on the sea, on the seas, and that he controls the water, or waters. Why is this a big deal? Why does the Bible make such a big deal about whether or not God controls the waters? Isn't it obvious that the seas, you know, they're where they are, and land's where they are, and they got a border? That seems, you know, to us from a scientific standpoint, just the way it is. But in the Bible, it's not just the way it is. It's the way God did it, and he did it for a reason. We're going to look into that today. So let's take a closer look at this subject. What's going on with the seas? Why is it phrased this way? What about sea monsters? The Bible's got sea monsters in it. I look forward to giving this one Evers around. Evers got a whole book on sea monsters. I don't know. At least most of the book is about sea monsters. Most of them mythical, not all of them. And a lot of them have more than one head, for whatever reason, in his book. I guess I should have. I didn't tell him I was talking about this. I should have brought the book. You could see. But how does all this matter to the Bible biblical writers? Why do they care? Why are they talking about it? And what does that have to do, lastly, with us today and with maybe even in our future? Well, let's look into it, and I'm going to start in Genesis. It's nice to start in Genesis, right? That's the beginning. Genesis chapter 1. I'm going to read the first 10 verses. You're familiar with it. I don't know that you need to turn there, but if you'd like to turn, go ahead. This is all, unless I say otherwise, and I don't think I will say otherwise, this is my quotes are all from the New American Standard, unless I open the Bible up because I got a King James here. Genesis 1, beginning in the verse 1. In the beginning. Now, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting myself already. Notice some of the things. I've got them underlined. You can't tell. I'll try to emphasize them. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was formless and void. And darkness was over the face of what? The deep. That's the way it reads in the New American Standard. And the Spirit of God was moving over the surface of what? The waters. Then God said, let there be light, and there was light. And God saw the light was good. And then God separated the light from darkness. God called the light day. The darkness he called night. It was evening and morning that day. One day. Then God said, let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Let it separate the waters from the waters. And God made this expanse, and he separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters which were above the expanse. And it was so. And God called the expanse heaven. And there was evening, and there was morning, a second day. And God said, let the waters below the heavens be gathered into one place. And we're getting to that where we got boundaries, right? Into one place, and let the dry land appear. And it was so. And God called the dry land earth, and the gathering of the waters he called the seas. And God saw that it was good. Now here's, you know, the foundation for everything else that follows, right? The first verses of the Bible. And I want to point out four things. I could point out a lot of things, but I'm going to point out four things. First of all, and this is important, the Bible viewpoint, as opposed to other ancient Near Eastern viewpoints that the Israelites were familiar with, the biblical viewpoint is that God created it all. God created everything. You read the other accounts, whether it's about Baal, or whether it's about Marduk, or whoever it is, they are on the scene, but so is the creation. And they do things to the creation, perhaps, or they have their wars and certain things result from that, but they are not responsible for the creation in the first place. The Bible says our God made it all in the first place. So that's one thing I want to draw attention to. The second thing is that at the time of Genesis 1, I don't mean when it was written, I mean when at the time it's talking about, at this time, the world apparently was not very organized or useful. It says it was without, you know, tohu and bohu in the Hebrew, and we talk about that. You know what all that means. It was formless and void, it says in the King James. Or formless and void is a New American Standard. It was without form and void in the King James. So it wasn't ready to be a place where we could live. And it's also interesting, for what it's worth, that the process of organization, according to these verses, starts with separation. I think that's interesting anyway. It says that, you know, the spirits brooding over the waters and so forth. It says God separated light from darkness. That's the first thing. We have a separation. Then we have a distinction between light and darkness, and we have an evening and a morning. We have a difference between the two. And it says later that he separated the waters which were below the expanse from the waters that were above the expanse. And in their worldview, you know, you had the waters down here on the earth and you have waters up there. We have clouds, I mean, whatever, but I think they thought it was even more than that. So the process of organization here began with separation. And then finally you get to the third day, and then we're separating the surface of the earth into areas where there are seas, oceans, and areas where there's land. So the way it's described here, it's a process of separating one thing from another, getting some organization to what was somewhat of a mess. And lastly, and this is where we're going to focus on today, the first thing that was done after you had separate light from darkness was to focus on the waters. And actually, that's 2 days worth of, you know, we separate the waters this way, then we separate the water from the land. So the waters were something that involved 2 days in the Genesis 1 account. So the process of making the earth ready for you and me to live on it, and all that came before us and all that are going to come after us, well, it begins with light and darkness being separated, and then putting the water in its place or places. Up there, here, wherever. That's fundamental to everything that follows in the Bible, is that God put the water in the right place. And I don't know, you say, well, who cares? What difference does it make? It makes a difference. At least to the people who wrote this book, it made a difference. And that's, you know, we're going to try to get into their sandals and see what they were thinking when they wrote this. and why it was important to them, and see what difference that makes for us. The Bible repeatedly, not just once, not just a little bit here, a little bit there, repeatedly, and we'll see a lot of them today, makes a point of stating that God is in control of the water. And again, you and I may think, well, who cares? God's in control of everything. But the fact that he was in control of the waters mattered. Mattered a lot. Let's read some verses. Psalm 24. There's a lot of psalms that we could turn to. I'm not going to turn to all of them by any means. A lot of the psalms have reference to this. Psalm 24, first two verses. The earth is the Lord's and all it contains, the world and those who dwell in it. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the rivers. So in a sense, the water is foundational to what God did. What's not stated here, stated in plenty of other places, but it's implied here. In order to do that, God had to have control of same. He had to control the waters in order to establish the earth on them. In Psalm 29, just a few chapters later, Psalm 29, verses 3 and 4, the voice of the Lord is upon the waters. Psalm 29, 3. The glory of God thunders. The Lord is over many waters. The voice of the Lord is powerful. The voice of the Lord is majestic. And verse 10, I'm not sure where verse 10, I didn't write where it starts, but I also want to read verse 10. The Lord sat as king at the flood. Yes, the Lord sits as king forever. So these are praise psalms, praising God. And I'm going to read from the Word Biblical Commentary here, just a few notes. I don't have to read it verbatim, but make a few points that were in that commentary. So praise begins with an affirmation that the Lord's voice is upon the waters. You could say that means, the words were taken to the psalmist is describing a thunderstorm or something like that. But the undertones here, as they put it, of the language, it points to something more. It's not just that God is more powerful than the water in a sense, or the thunderstorms could be God's voice. No. I mean, not. I can't say that the person who wrote the psalm wasn't thinking that, but there's more to it than that. That this it may have been the inspiration for what he wrote. But it's also a reflection or an adaptation of common ancient mythological viewpoint of how the world came to be. And I've talked about that. I've talked about some of that before. I'll just read here what the Word Biblical Commentary says. It talks about reflecting on an adaptation of the Canaanite Ugaritic religious thought in the Ugaritic texts. There was Yam, which means sea, and there was a god of the mighty waters and so forth. Yet the chaotic god, Yam, was conquered by Baal. This doesn't matter. We don't need to know this paganism, but the point was that was the world that the Israelites lived in. That was something that was familiar to them. An allusion to this mythological incident is already contained in the Song of the Sea. That's, from an ancient thing there in Exodus chapter 15, when they passed through the Red Sea. And the voice that says that the Lord is described not merely as a deity whose thunderous voice is heard, but one victorious over the chaotic forces symbolized by the mighty waters. The poetry amplifies the theme of the Lord as a warrior. So I could have read other things. I could have read all kinds of resources here. Bottom line is, in the ancient world, these oceans, these seas, these waters, which could at any time be out of control with a hurricane or tsunami or a storm or whatever, the waters were symbolic of chaos, symbolic of a lack of control. And for the biblical writers to say, Yahweh controls them. He created them in the first place, and he has total control over them. That was a way of saying, look, our God's better than your God, whatever is one way of putting it. Like the old kennel racing commercial, whatever, my dog better than your dog or whatever. Our God's better than your God. And it's in the Bible all the time. There are references to other gods. Now, we don't believe that they are other gods in the same sense, but there are demons that control the nations of the earth and so forth from the biblical perspective. So we realize that in one sense there were other gods. Paul calls them demons when he would get to the New Testament. But the point is there's a spirit realm and there's control out there. But God's over it all. God has control of it all. And our God, Israel could say, is better than your God, and more powerful than your God. And the Bible makes that point again and again and again. And a lot of times it uses the symbolism of water to make that point. Why? Because that was a very common way of approaching it. I didn't think of one. Maybe you can think of one and raise your hand when you come up with it. I should have tried to think of what, you know, just because we use something as an expression in describing something, a concept that we want to make, and we want to make the point to somebody else. Just because we use a concept doesn't necessarily mean that we believe that was true. Oh, I can think of an example. Here you go. I think you're lying, right? I can say, your nose is getting longer. Do I believe anybody's nose gets longer? Do I believe the story of Pinocchio? No. But it's something everybody understands. Okay? That's an example. Maybe it's not a good one, but that's an example. So the Bible does the same thing. Because you have these myths around that the waters were uncontrollable and chaos, and if you wanted to be powerful, you had to be in control of those. The Bible makes the point over and over again that God is, you know, Yahweh, the God of Israel, is in control of those waters. He's able to control the seas. He has no problem with chaos. He's in control of it. And you read the Ugaritic text or you read the Mesopotamian text that were prior to that, and you realize that God's had no control over chaos. In fact, the gods contributed to the chaos, usually, or were the cause of the chaos in the first place. So Yahweh's presented as being somebody, a God that's different. He brings order to the chaos. He brings, the world becomes more civilized because of his activity. And these themes are carried throughout the entire Bible, all the way to the end. We're going to go to the end before we finish today. In Psalm 46, very famous psalm because it's put to music a lot. I won't sing. It's hard for me to read this without singing, though I love the song. God is our refuge and strength, a very present help in trouble. Psalm 46. Therefore, we will not fear, though the earth should change, and though the mountains slip into the heart of the sea, though its waters roar and foam, though the mountains quake at its swelling pride. What's the point there? The point is, you know, we don't need to fear the unknown. That the ocean, you know, if you even for us, I mean, we know because we fly over it or we take a cruise and we see, you know, it seems a little bit tame. It's tame until you have a hurricane or a tsunami or some other thing. It's not very tame then. But, you know, to the ancients, it was even more scary because they didn't understand how it all worked. We understand how it all works, but we can't control it. They couldn't control it, and they didn't even understand how it worked and why it was the way it was. But the biblical writers again and again make the point that there's no need to fear because Yahweh is in control of it all. And Yahweh will use it to Israel's advantage when he needs to. And there are examples of that we'll look at. Though the waters roar and foam. Again, is the people in the Bible just, you know, obsessed with water and they're afraid of water? No. They're making a bigger point than just that you don't need to fear going out in the ocean, you know. That's not the point. The point is that the oceans, the seas, these large bodies of water are symbolic of chaos. And God is in control of that. God is in control. Psalm 77, verses 16 through 20. Psalm 77, verses 16 to 20. The waters saw you, O God. The waters saw you. They were in anguish. The deeps, there's another term there that you see a lot in the Bible. The deeps also trembled. The clouds poured out water. The skies gave forth a sound. Your arrows flashed here and there. You know, lightning. The sound of your thunder was in the whirlwind. The lightnings lit up the world. The earth trembled and shook. Your way was in the sea and your paths in the mighty waters. And your footprints may not be known. Now, you know what comes after that. I haven't read it yet, but this sounds like this is a very cosmic description of what, you know, the oceans and God being in control of it all. But then he says, you led your people like a flock by the hand of Moses and Aaron. You know, in the midst of all this chaos of the ocean, you know, or Red Sea, whatever, in the midst of all this, We got a shepherd leading people calmly through. It's a beautiful word picture. It's a beautiful word picture of how when God is involved, chaos is not a problem. In fact, we have order, and we have peace, and we have calm. And these verses here in Psalm 77 make that clear. That in the midst of all, and there were a lot of manifestations, even in Sinai, that came later. And they had the plagues in Egypt and so forth. But the path was in mighty waters. You know, God delivered Israel from Egypt by taking him through water. That's, all right, we take that for granted. Okay, they went through the Red Sea. But do you understand it's kind of like an exclamation point? Or like a, so there. You know, if you get what's going on here. It's not just that Israel was delivered by the hand of God, but he did it by taking him through water. It's even better, you know, whatever. It's kind of an in-your-face thing in a way. I'm not saying that God's in your face in a negative way. But it's the way it's written, the way the Psalms write it, the way Exodus writes, the way the Exodus 15, I don't know if we go there or not. I forgot if I put it in there. But, you know, the song of celebration after they went through the Red Sea. God is in control. And he's not afraid of the water. We don't need to be afraid of the water. We can walk through. You don't even see a footprint. Walk through like a bunch of sheep being led by a shepherd. So God has his way with the waters. That's clear again and again and again. Israel need not fear. And now we had, as I mentioned, the word deep. And I'm going to bring in a word at a time here. And you see that these themes go throughout the entire Bible. And sometimes we read a verse and we have our own idea about what it means and how it fits. And that's beautiful and that's fine. And we may be exactly right. What sometimes we may not appreciate is how it's connected to a whole lot of other things. And that's part of what I want to point out today. The word deep comes up a lot of times in this same context. Now I'm going to read, where's this? Oh, there we go. From Psalms, an introduction and commentary, Tremper Longman. As the psalmist retells the story of the sea crossing, he personifies the waters. The waters saw God coming and grew afraid. You know, they're being personified here. In this way, the psalmist evokes the mythological image of the creator God who is in control of the sea, representing chaos. The seas represent chaos. And defeats it. God controls the waters of chaos. He created a path through the sea to allow his people to escape to safety. This picture of the Israelites' escape is not that of a mad, disorderly rush, as you might think it would be if all of a sudden the sea opened up. Well, I better get through there. No, the picture is just walk through calmly. Like a flock of sheep is the way he words it. Psalm 93. I'll read the whole psalm. It's a short one. Psalm 93. The Lord reigns. He is clothed with majesty. The Lord has clothed and girded himself with strength. Indeed, the world is firmly established. It will not be moved. Your throne is established from of old. You are from everlasting. The floods have lifted up, O Lord. The floods have lifted up their voice. The floods lift up their pounding waves, more than the sound of many waters, than the mighty breakers of the sea. The Lord on high is mighty. Your testimonies are fully confirmed. Holiness befits your house, O Lord, forevermore. Here's another word sometimes used to, in the same context. It's all, you know, all ties together. And that is flood. You know, God controls the floods. And once again, you know, and this is outside the subject here of this sermon, but when you read I can't say it begins with an A, but it's the Mesopotamian flood story. It's not that the gods are in control of that flood. But you read, you know, in the Bible, God's in control. God's in control. It's not something that's out of control. It's something that God does and has a purpose for. So now we have waters, of course, the seas. We have the deep, and now we have flood or floods, another term that's also used in the same context. And Longman says, in addition here, his ancient Near Eastern myths pitted the God of creation against the forces of chaos, represented by God, the God of the sea. And he talks about the Enumelish, where you have Marduk and Tiamat and all that, and you can look into that sometime if you want to. But it involved, those myths involved the gods and the seas. Tiamat was actually symbolic of the sea. So it was part of their culture that if you were going to be the god, you better be the one who can control the waters. And, of course, God is. He is capable of controlling the waters and everything else. In fact, he made it. Psalm 114, another psalm here. And, again, I can read the whole thing. It's short. When Israel, and we sing, this is another one we sing. I won't sing it. When Israel went forth from Egypt, the house of Jacob from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary and Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled. The Jordan turned back. So now I'm interrupting here. We don't have a sea. We have a river. It's the same thing. It's the water. Same symbolism. Jordan turned back. The mountains skip like rams. The hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? All right, well, it wasn't a sea that fled. But you see, it's a bigger picture here. It's a bigger picture of what was going on. O Jordan, that you turned back. It was a river, and a little river at that. O mountains that you skip like rams, O hills like lambs, tremble, O earth, before the Lord, before the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water and the flint into a fountain of water. So here we have rivers, or the Jordan. Again, a symbol of chaos, something that can't be controlled. But yet, when Israel was led into the promised land and they had to cross the Jordan, what happened? Remember, the ark went in and the water stopped and they walked across. God's in control of the water. It's again and again. And not just again and again, but in these two examples, having to do with the deliverance, you know, the rescue of Israel from Egypt, which has a lot to do, you know, according to the New Testament, it's the perfect picture of our personal salvation, that God leads us out of Egypt. And what? Guess what? He has to take us through the waters too, whether it's River Jordan or Red Sea. He has to take us through our own waters of chaos. And he's perfectly capable of it, because he's done it before. And the examples are there. So we have river added to the list here of words that kind of all mean the same thing. Or use, I shouldn't say mean the same thing, but they are used in the same way to draw the same picture. The waters of chaos are always in retreat when God's involved. Whether it's the Jordan, whether it's the Red Sea, whether it's the whole waters around the whole earth in Genesis 1, whatever it is. Psalm 124. Like I said, there's a lot of psalms. I'm just looking at a few. Verses 4 and 5 of Psalm 124. Had it not been the Lord who was on our side, let Israel now say, had it not been the Lord who was on our side when men rose up against us, then they would have swallowed us alive. When their anger was kindled against us, then the waters would have engulfed us. The stream would have swept over our soul. Then the raging waters would have swept over our soul. So again, just using the symbolism here of water being something that, as humans, we can't really control too much. And when we go through certain things, you know, we're talking about the ducks today, you know, it's kind of like being inundated, being flooded, right? Sometimes you've been there. You've been in situations where it's like you're going through a flood. Maybe you've been through a literal flood. But, you know, sometimes in our lives, we're in situations that we could describe it's a flood of events that tend to overwhelm us. And God, again and again, is presented in the Bible as being perfectly capable of handling that, whether it's literal H2O or our own personal flood or problems. Just a couple more, and then we'll move to a different aspect of this. In Habakkuk. Chapter 3 and 2 verses, verse 8 and verse 15. Did the Lord rage against the rivers, or was your anger against the rivers? Or was your wrath against the sea that you rode on your horses, on your chariots of salvation? Finally get to verse 15. It says, you trampled on the sea with your horses, on the surge of many waters. So here you're getting later. We're not in the Psalms, we're not in Exodus. But, you know, the symbolism is still there. But God, in his control of everything, that includes his control of the waters, which, humanly speaking, we have no control over. Anybody, any of you ever canoe or kayak or anything like that? And so you know, if you've done it on streams, You can have this little dinky little stream. You know, where I live, there's one called Catoctin Creek. And if you go way up north on Catoctin Creek, it's a very small little creek. But you can run it in the, you can run it, Middle Creek, and there's a couple other creeks that feed into it. You can run that in the spring when the water, when there's a lot of water. And you know what? It's dangerous. Why is it dangerous? It's a little creek. Because you don't have control. This is for the benefit of those of you that haven't kayaked or canoe. You don't have control over that water. And if there's a strainer, you know, a limb that's falling down over the creek, you could drown or you know, break your neck or whatever. You get caught underneath of that. And it happens. It happens. And you're all warned, you know, we're people that do that are warned about that. So even little, what seem to be little creeks can kill you. So the whole idea of water being dangerous has a basis in reality. You know, that it, water is something that we can't control. We put a dam up, that's how we control it, right? But, you know, water unbounded is, it can be very dangerous. And that's why, you know, going way back into the beginning of the sermon, you know, God put boundaries on the sea. He puts boundaries so that we're safe. One more, Jeremiah. There's more scriptures, but there's one more before we shift gears just a little. Jeremiah 51 and verses 42 and 43. Jeremiah 51 and verses 42 and 43. And this is kind of like, I'm throwing this in for proof that water doesn't necessarily mean water. You say, what? All right, let's read it. The sea has come up over Babylon. She has been engulfed with its tumultuous waves. Her cities have become an object of horror, a parched land and a desert, a land in which no man lives and through which no son of man passes. All right, if this is talking about literal seas, then how can it be a parched land? All right, that's my point. Is that it's obvious at times that in this case, it's not even literal. It's only symbolic. The sea, something that was beyond Babylon's control came and took it over. It's called the Persian Empire. But, you know, that's, you know, Babylon, the city even. So it's symbolic of destruction. A return to what? Chaos. There was order. Babylon was, you know, the city, the model city back in, you know, that civilization. What could be greater than Babylon? Nebuchadnezzar, remember, he's oh, I built all this, it's wonderful, you know, before he went insane. It was something to be seen. And God says, you know, it's in this prophecy, it's going to return to chaos. It's going to be covered by the ocean, not necessarily literally, but figuratively in that all this beauty, all this order, all this, this what you see man has created, is going to go back to chaos. So, we've seen repeatedly, maybe plenty or too many, that God is portrayed in Scripture as having control over the waters, over the seas, whether they're rivers, the deep, whatever you want to call it, he has control. No problem. Now let's look at another aspect of this, and I kind of hinted at it at the beginning. Not only do we have in the Bible seas that are deep, but the Bible repeatedly talks about certain creatures in the sea that are somewhat unusual. And maybe because, you know, you don't see it. If you're Israel, you don't, you know, you're not going out, you don't see. You get these legends. You get, it's Nessie, you know, it's a Loch Ness. We don't know if she's there or not, you know, but it's because so deep. Well, that's a modern one, right? They had it too. And they had evidence that maybe there were certain things. And there were some big animals. We got, you know, blue whale. What are they, 300 feet long? Football field long? That's a monstrous. I don't know if anybody saw it back then. Maybe they saw smaller ones and that was big enough. So we have some huge animals that live in the ocean. But we also have some that probably were just symbolic. Let's look at a few verses. Job chapter 7. We're going to go back to Job here. Job 7 and verse 12. And this is an interesting little thing. You know, Job is going back and forth with his friends and trying to defend himself from their accusations. And he wasn't getting anywhere usually. And in Job 7, he's already frustrated. We're only in chapter 7. He's already pretty frustrated. And, you know, God has, in his view, done things that are unfair to Job. Job didn't deserve it. And he's pleading his innocence and saying, you know, I just don't deserve this treatment. And he's trying to tell his friends that, and his friends say, hey, God wouldn't do this to you if you weren't evil, somehow or another. And not calling him evil, but they're saying he must have sinned, brought it on himself. And Job's frustrated with this. And he not only is he sure he didn't do anything to deserve it, he can't figure out why God's picking on him. Like, who am I that God's got to pick on me? And he says in verse 12 of chapter 7, am I the sea or a sea monster that you set a guard over me? What's his point there? Well, in whatever time the book of Job was written, and this idea that you had the deep and you had these creatures of the deep and they're out of control. Unless Yahweh has control, good. But, other than that, you weren't so sure there was any control. So Job's saying, am I one of those? Does God need to put a border around me like he has to put around the ocean that we read before? He puts a border so that the waves only go so far. Am I that important that God has to pay all this attention to me? That's his point here in chapter 7, verse 12. But he uses terminology from the popular myths and legends. A sea monster. And I could go into details. I won't read it. There's the old creation myths that have certain stories about the seas and so forth. But it also had monsters in the sea. It had sea gods and sea monsters, and there are different words. One of them is Tanin, the monster, and that's actually used sometimes in Scripture. Sometimes that word looks like a plural of jackal. So I don't know anything about Hebrew, but you got to be careful which one it's talking about. Sometimes it means a jackal. I'm not going to read all this from one of the commentaries, but the point is that Job was taking what was popular knowledge, his popular understanding of the time, and I'm not going to say whether he believed there were sea monsters or weren't sea monsters. That's not the point. The point is everybody thought there were. That was kind of the common thing, and God had to be in control of it, and God had to notice where they were, know where they were. And Job's point was, am I that important? Am I like a sea monster that God has to know where I am and take care of me? At point, he's saying no, he wasn't that important. In chapter 9 and verse 13 of Job, and I'm just breaking into these thoughts to show how these words are used. God will not turn back his anger, Job 9 and verse 13. Beneath him crouch the helpers of Rahab. Like, who's Rahab? Well, in Joshua and Jericho? No. Rahab, and I can't give you a detailed explanation of Rahab, but it's a word that's used for a sea monster. It's used several times in Scripture. I don't know if there's anything. I have another commentary note here, but I don't know if I want to read it all. It's just saying the sea monster Rahab is a symbol of chaos and her partisans, her helpers. There's no one who can hold God back, not even the sea monster, not all the people that want to help her. So I'll just leave it at that. let's read another one. This again is in Job. This time it's verse 8 and 14, 8 to 14 of Job 26. Job 26, verses 8 to 14. And here's Bildad. Still, we're all the way up in chapter 26, and he's still going back and forth with his friends. And this is Bildad saying, talking about God, he wraps up the waters in his clouds. Okay, so again, we're talking about controlling the water. God has to control the water that's up there, too, as well as the water that's down here. And the water up we get later that's somewhere else. And the cloud does not burst under them. He says wrap. I don't know what they thought about clouds and how they understood them, but the terminology here is symbolic. It's just wrapped up like a canteen, wineskin, something like that. And the water doesn't get out. He obscures the face of the full moon and spreads his cloud over it. He has inscribed a circle on the surface of the waters at the boundary of light and darkness. That's interesting. The pillars of heaven tremble and are amazed at his rebuke. He quieted the sea with his power, and by his understanding, he shattered Rahab. By his understanding. So it's not just his power, but God's understanding is appealed to several times in Scripture as being part of what was involved in the creative process in the beginning. And here it's talking about being in control of the sea monsters. And we're not talking about necessarily literal sea monsters. The point is God's in control of everything, including the unknown that's out there, the Nessie that's at the bottom of Loch Ness or whatever. God's in control of all that. We don't need to worry about it. And he's smart enough, not just powerful enough, but also smart enough to take care of that. By his breath, the heavens are cleared, and his hand has pierced the fleeing serpent. So now Rahab's compared to a serpent, or a, you know, some kind of a serpentine kind of a sea monster. Behold, these are the fringes of his ways, and how faint a word we hear of him by his mighty, but his mighty thunder. Who can understand? What does it mean? These are just fringes. In other words, God is so powerful. This is just a little taste of what God can do. This isn't can't describe God in fully, but he's powerful against all this, and that's just a fringe. That's just on the outside of what God's capable of. And I could read you more about Rahab, but I don't think I will, except to say, I'll read one thing. We are still in the same mythological picture here, and this is from, again, this is a commentary by on the book of Job, and I don't know the name of the commentary, sorry. We are still in the same mythological picture here. And so they're starting. The slaying of the serpent shows clearly enough that the setting is still primordial times. It wasn't that God is busy doing this right now, it's that God had to do it. Well, did God have to do it? Not really, it's symbolic. Because the other myths that were out there show that the gods who eventually achieved supremacy or dominance in their cultures were the ones who could defeat the sea monsters. So Yahweh can do that too. That's the point. Not that he necessarily had to, but that's, he's capable of that. Okay, I don't need to read any more there. In Isaiah 51, in Isaiah 51, and verses 9 and 10. Now, why do I want to turn to all these? Well, because it's a theme that goes through the whole Bible. And when you spot that, you know, hopefully after this sermon, when you get to something that's talking about waters or sea dragons or Rahab or Leviathan that we'll get to in a minute, anyway, you'll get, it's a bigger picture than just what's in that one verse. It's tied to a whole lot of other things. Isaiah 51, verses 9 and 10. Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not you who cut Rahab in pieces? Again, the similar, you know, God can handle all this. Who pierced the dragon? Was it not you who dried up the sea? Well, what's that? You know, when Israel got out of Egypt. The waters of the great deep, you made the depths of the sea as a pathway for the redeemed to cross over. Again, symbolic of our own journey. So we have these themes all put together. You know, the theme of crossing the sea on dry land, the theme of piercing the dragon. All, you know, they all mean, if not exactly the same thing, they're different ways of saying the same thing. And they all paint this picture of a God who is more powerful than chaos. Psalm 89. We're still talking about Rahab and the sea monsters. Psalm 89, verses 8 through 10. Psalm 89. O Lord God of hosts, who is like you, O mighty Lord? Your faithfulness surrounds you. You rule the swelling of the sea. When its waves rise, you still them. You yourself crushed Rahab like one who is slain. You scattered your enemies with your mighty arm. So it's just describing how great God is. God can do that. God, his right arm can take care of all the enemies, including this kind of nebulous idea of a sea monster that's a symbolic of chaos and needs to be controlled. That's the word Rahab. I didn't talk about yet about another word that's usually translated sea monster, and that's Tanim that I mentioned to you before. And I don't know. Again, I won't read to you all the commentary that I have here. I could. That's the one, as I mentioned, you have to be careful because the word is the plural of the word for jackals looks like the same as this monster. So you got to look at the context to see which it is if you're a translator. All right, I can skip that. Isaiah 27. Isaiah 27 and verse 1. In that day when the Lord will punish Leviathan, the fleeing serpent, with his fierce and great and mighty sword, even Leviathan, the twisted serpent, he will kill the dragon who lives in the sea. So here you have the sea dragon, but you also have a name, a proper name given it to it. We use the word Leviathan to talk about a huge whale. one of my favorite songs by a group called Schooner Fair, called Leviathan, about the whales. It's a beautiful, beautiful song. And here, it's got Isaiah's not even talking about a sea monster. He's talking about Tyre, the city. You see, so again, it's symbolic. It's symbolic. But everybody understood that. Leviathan is used in the Bible as a word. I think I have some resources here on that. But it's used as a real world, animal that lives in the ocean. But it's also used in a symbolic sense for things that we don't know about, the huge, huge chaos kind of dragons as well. And here it's called a twisted serpent. So you get that picture. If I had my grandson's book here, the pictures of the sea serpents, they usually look like multi-headed snakes. You've seen that kind of stuff, right? That's not new. Those mythologies go way back, way back. And we'll see them right in the Bible. You think, what? Now they're there. So Leviathan, here is symbolic of Tyre, but something that God's in control of, not a problem. Psalm 74, verses 13 and 14. You divided the sea, Psalm 74, by your strength. That's a picture of the Exodus again. You broke the heads of the sea monsters in the waters. Oh, okay. You crushed the heads of Leviathan. Guess what? Heads is plural. That's what people had in their mind. Does that mean, I don't believe that means literally that God was crushing three-headed sea monsters or five-headed or seven-headed sea monsters. I don't believe that. That's my personal feeling. But that's part of the overall picture, that the common picture that they had. And the point is that God is powerful enough to do that. If that's what a God needs to do, God can do it. And in their world, that's the kind of stuff that God needed to do. You crushed the heads, plural, of Leviathan. You gave him food. You gave him as food, for the creatures of the wilderness. Now you crushed him. He's down on the bottom of the ocean being eaten by crabs or whatever. God subdued. I don't know if I turn to it later, but I said that's one example. But in the prophecies, and we understand the prophecies are symbolic, right? But you get into Revelation and these dragons have more than one head. That's odd. No, it's not odd. That was normal. Dragons had more than one head. Seven heads, 10 horns, No problem. Sea serpents can have all that. Nobody thought they were literal, but that was part of the common mythology. So for a dream to have that visualization and interpretation, no, it's normal for that time. Psalm 104, verse 25 to 26. Psalm 104. There is the sea, great and broad, in which are swarms without number, animals both small and great. There the ships move along, and Leviathan, which you have formed to sport in it. So here's a case of where there are sea monsters and Leviathan used in a real sense for the big creatures that do live in the ocean. So it's used in both ways in the Bible. God created the real ones, all right? He created the real sea monsters. And, we still have this, here we are in the 21st century, but do we have a symbolism that goes with any of this? Have you heard of people, when they face a big obstacle, and they're like Beowulf, right? They got the sword, what do they do? What do you do when you succeed in conquering some huge obstacle? You've slayed the dragon. We still use that, okay? Well, it was that way, it's not, so in that sense, we're no different. No different than they were. It's a common way of looking at things. You slay the dragon. Do we think there's a real dragon? No. If there was one, but it doesn't mean that there is a real one. It's just it's a way of saying you've conquered whatever the obstacle is. When you go back to Genesis 1 where we started, there was separation. I didn't bring this out yet, but I'll bring it out now. The whole world was tohu and bohu, right? And God had to bring some kind of organization, some kind of a difference between the chaos and confusion and a place that was safe for people like us to live. It's one of the songs. It's in the hymnal, right? Mark Grant, oh, what's it called? I don't know the name of the song, but it talks about da 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 da. You know, God created a place where he could grow his family, grow us. How did he go about doing that? He separated chaos from areas that could be peaceful. All right, now we've got that. We already got that. What's interesting is that when the Bible wants to make the point that for some reason or another, there is a return to chaos, guess what happens? That separation stops. And the most obvious example is what? The flood of Noah. You know, God separated the water and put it where it needed to be so that there could be dry land and people could live. And then we have a flood. What does the flood do? The flood takes the water and puts it back where it wasn't supposed to be. So you return to chaos. God had his reasons. But the point is, we've created a state where the chaos is at bay. You know, ah, that's a pun. And, you know, chaos is at bay because you have boundaries to the ocean. But that chaos, you know, it said the fountains of the deep opened up and all kinds of things. So you had a reversal of what happened in creation at the time of the flood, and all of a sudden we have chaos again. That was part of God's plan. Now, I've talked about sea creatures, Leviathan, Rahab. Let's talk about one specific sea creature. And you know this one too. It's the book of Jonah, right? There's a very specific sea creature there in Jonah 2. And what's interesting, there's a lot of things that are interesting here. But what's interesting is Jonah's prayer. He gets swallowed by this great sea creature. And you know, great, we can think, well, that means it's huge. Not necessarily everything's great in Jonah. You know, you got a great city, you know, all the people. You know. So the superlatives abound in the book of Jonah. But in any event, there's this creature that can swallow Jonah. When Jonah's down there in his gut, he makes his prayer. And what you find when you read this prayer is it's very much like a lot of psalms, because there's a certain formula to how these psalms of supplication where you were in trouble and you needed God's help. They're just like this. Let's look at it. Jonah chapter 2, verse 1. Jonah prayed to the Lord his God from the stomach of the fish, and he said, I called out of my distress to the Lord, and he answered me. I cried for help from the depth of Sheol. We're going to go there in a minute. I called from the depth of Sheol. You heard my voice, for you had cast me into the deep, into the heart of the sea. So these are all these things that we already talked about, the deep, right? In the heart of the seas. We didn't talk about Sheol yet. We're going there. This is the segue. Your breakers and billows passed over me. So I said, I have been expelled from your sight. Nevertheless, I will look again towards your holy temple. Water encompassed me to the point of death. So now it's not just water and chaos, but it's a water that's going to kill him. Or in the belly of this fish is going to kill him. The great deep engulfed me. That phrase that we already looked at. Weeds were wrapped around my head. I descended to the roots of the mountains. The earth with its bars was around me forever. But you have brought up my life from the pit. O Lord my God, while I was fainting away, I remembered the Lord, and my prayer came to you into your holy temple. And those who regard vain idols forsake their faithfulness, but I will sacrifice to you with the voice of thanksgiving. That which I have vowed I will pay. Salvation is from the Lord. And you can look at that. I don't know. I don't know that I brought that. I have another one. I don't. But you could look at any number of psalms that are structured the same way. You know, the crying out to God that, yeah, I'm in trouble. I'm down in the depths. I'm on my way to Sheol, which I'll talk about in a minute. And I need to be saved from this. And God, who's in control of the depths and all of that, and Sheol and everything, lifts us out of where we are in our troubles. The prayer that we find, and let's see what the source is here. This is from a commentary on the Minor Prophets. The prayer that we find in chapter 2, verses 2 to 9, is a typical song of thanksgiving with which any pious Israelite could identify. This type is found frequently in the Psalter, and he gives examples here, Psalm 30, 32, 34, 92, 116, so on. You know, the structure was well known. While this passage in Jonah alters the typical structure to some extent, such songs of thanksgiving were made up of an introduction, a description of the distress or trouble in which the psalmist found himself, a report of God's deliverance, and a conclusion that sometimes included a reference to a vow. The songs were sung in response to some specific deed of deliverance and were usually intended to be sung in the worshiping congregation. So that's just a little background there. And he says, now his topic here is the book of Jonah and this prayer, but he identifies with all of what we've just talked about. He says, to comprehend the content of this psalm, we need to have some understanding of the Hebrew worldview, of the symbol of the sea, the deep, flood, and of the Old Testament conception of death. According to the portrayal of the world that we find in Genesis 1 and throughout the scriptures, the universe was three-storied, with the heaven above, the earth in the middle, and Sheol, the place of the dead, under the earth. The earth floated on a subterranean waters and was anchored in those waters by pillars or mountains, and below the subterranean waters was the realm of Sheol. Now, we know the earth is structured differently than that, but they didn't. And that's what you see in the writings. And the Bible's consistent with that. God wasn't in the business of revealing to his servants the actual composition of the earth and how the mantle and, the middle's hot and all. That wasn't his point. So the common worldview was common among the people who wrote the Bible as well. So such is the picture of Jonah that is portrayed in this psalm. He has been cast into the sea, and the chaotic waters are closing around him. And as he sinks down through them toward Sheol, or a pit, so that's why the author speaking of Jonah is in an actual sea, but and talking about seaweed and so forth, really what's going on is he's on the way to the place, the abode of the dead, which in the Old Testament in Hebrew is Sheol. That's where the dead were seen to go. And it was kind of like this underground water. You think, well, what's that mean? Well, what does the second commandment say? Don't make for yourself any idol of any likeness that's in heaven above, or the earth beneath, or the waters under the earth. That's the way they saw it. And that was, the abode of the dead. Doesn't mean you went down there and eternal, a soul and something like that. It's just that that was an idea of what happened to the dead. So they went to this place called Sheol, and it was down there. They're dead. I don't know what they thought about that, but that was what they supposedly went. And of course, later on, we get in the New Testament, we realize that that it's demons that really inhabit these kind of areas. If we want to talk about things that are actually alive, there are demons. So we have another component. We have Sheol, which is the abode of the dead, and it's perceived as being down there and also having to do with water. And as you descend in the waters of chaos, you're on your way to what? Sheol, meaning death. Jonah was on his way to death. He understood that. So you have the waters under the earth. Psalm 130, verses 1 and 2. Out of the depths I have cried to you, O Lord. Lord, hear my voice. Out of the depths. All right? Why? You're down. We use that figuratively. Say, oh, I'm down. I'm down at a low place. I need God's help. But for them, it meant even more than that, because it was symbolic of being down close to death, close to Sheol. Let your ears be attentive to the voice of my supplications. In Psalm 69, verses 1 to 2, save me, O God, from the waters, for the waters have threatened my life. I have sunk in a deep mire. And we got another word, mire. And there is no foothold. I've come into deep waters, and a flood overflows me. All those terms in this one verse or two verses, all the terms that we've already seen, they're all symbolic of being down there. Verse 14, deliver me from the mire and do not let me sink. May I be delivered from my foes and from the deep waters. Because what is the deep waters are symbolic in the end with death. If that's where you end up, you're dead. Okay. What about the New Testament? I've already done a lot of this in the Old Testament, so what does it matter? Let's look at the New Testament, because John says at the end of his gospel, right, he says, we could have filled books and books full of all these things, but I'm telling you what I'm telling you because you need to understand who Jesus was. So the gospel writers have that as a goal. They want people to understand, at least to the extent that they understood it, who Jesus was and what he was. And because of that, they made sure that certain things were included in their accounts. As John says, they could have wrote books full of, you know, of all these things. They didn't. They only wrote small books. But they had to, by throwing out all kinds of things that Jesus did and saying, I don't have room for that, they had to decide what was going to be in them, right? There's certain things they included that are very symbolic. And now that you've got the background from the Old Testament, you'll see, if you didn't ever see it before, you'll see why they were included and what the point was. Mark chapter 4, verse 35. Mark 4, verse 35. I'm going to read to verse 41. On that day, when evening came, he said to them, let's go over to the other side. Now, I've talked about that before. They were near wherever they were, Capernaum or whatever. And to go to the other side of the lake, the Sea of Galilee, was to go to a non-Jewish area. And as I recall, like when they did go over there, they weren't even getting out of the boat. Leaving the crowd, they took him along with them in their boat, just as he was, and the other boats were with him. And there arose a fierce gale of wind, and the waves were breaking over the boat so much that the boat was already filling up, and Jesus himself was in the stern, asleep on the cushion. So you know the story. They woke him and said to him, teacher, don't you care that we're going to die? Perishing is the word in the New American Standard. And he got up and he rebuked the wind and said to the sea, hush, be still. And the wind died down and it became perfectly calm. And he said to them, why were you afraid? How is it that you have no faith? And they became very much afraid, and they said to one another, who is this that even the wind and the sea obey him? Why did Mark include this? Because it's Yahweh who controls the sea and the wind. And Jesus could do that with the power that his Father gave him, right? This is revealing who Jesus is, revealing his authority, where he's from, who sent him. The waters, what waters? Galilee, okay, but it's the waters of chaos. It meant more than just the waters of the Sea of Galilee. It was symbolic. Jesus controls the waters of chaos also. And he can just tell it to be calm. Who is this? Who is this guy? Well, that's just one example. In Mark chapter 6, verses 42, or 45, sorry, to 52. Immediately Jesus made his disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he himself was sending the crowd away. And after bidding them farewell, he left for a mountain to pray. And while it was evening, or when it was evening, the boat was in the middle of the sea, and he was alone on the land. And seeing them straining at the oars, because the wind was blowing in the wrong direction, at about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them walking on the sea. And he intended to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they supposed he was a ghost and cried out, for they saw him and they were terrified. Excuse me. But immediately he spoke with them, and he said to them, take courage. It's me. Don't be afraid. And he got into the boat with them, and the wind stopped. And they were utterly astonished, for they had not gained any insight from the incident of the loaves, but their heart was hardened. So they didn't get it yet. But what was Jesus showing them? Again, he's showing them, and Mark included it, to show that, look, this guy has control over the water. He's just like Yahweh in the Old Testament. Now, they didn't get it yet. They still didn't understand. But they understood it later, and they stuck it in the Gospels. And, you know, God had parted the sea so that Israel could get out of Egypt. God parted or plugged up, whatever you want to say, the Jordan, so they could enter into Canaan. So God, through these miracles, is showing that his Son has power, and that he is God's Son. God has mastery over the waters, literal water and figurative chaos. Now, there's one other word. I think I'll stop with this word that we haven't come to yet, that's also tied in with all this. And this will take us to the end of the sermon. One more subject. In Luke chapter 8 and verse 26 to 31. Luke 8, verse 26. Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which was opposite Galilee. This was the area they didn't want to go to. The disciples weren't crazy about going to the other side. And when he came out of the land, he was met by a man from the city who was possessed by a devil. It never says that the disciples got out of the boat, but Jesus did. And it was a demoniac that he met. And he hadn't put on any clothing for a long time. He was not living in the house, but in tombs. And seeing Jesus, he cried out and fell before him and said in a loud voice, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, don't torment me." Well, this guy, you know, this is a demon talking, right? "For he had commanded the unclean spirit, to come out of this man, for it had seized him many times, and he was bound with chains and shackles and kept under guard. And yet he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. And Jesus asked him, 'What's your name?' And he said, 'Legion, for many demons had entered him.'" You know the story. "And they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss." Into the abyss. Here we have another word. And amazingly enough, this word's tied in with all the others. It's a description of the underworld. It's, you know, down there. A place of imprisonment for disobedient spirits. It's the way it's worded in the Revelation in the New Testament. The realm of the dead is tied in with Sheol in the Hebrew. But it's called an abyss because it's so deep it can't ever be filled up. Again, it's the deeps, right? It's this symbol of the chaos that we don't have any control over. In this word, by the way, is used in the Septuagint, which is a Greek translation of the Old Testament, for words like flood or floods of water. So, you know, it's also tied in with the realm of the dead and Sheol. So the word is tied in with the waters and the flood, the floods of waters. And finally, you know, when you get to the New Testament, it's also a place that's connected with unclean spirits, and that's how it's used. We see it in Revelation, the demons. it's seen kind of as a prison for the spirits that have rebelled against God. Okay, I don't read any more about that. In Revelation, we're going to get to the book of Revelation now. Chapter 9, verse 1. "Fifth angel sounded. I saw a star from heaven that had fallen to the earth. The key of the bottomless pit, the abyss, was given to him." And verse 11 says, "They have a king over them, the angel of the abyss, and his name in Hebrew is Abaddon. And in the Greek, his name has the name Apollyon." So here you have this same, it's a different symbol, but it's for the same thing. This area that's out of the control of humans, but God's in control. And now it's also pictured, it takes on the additional characteristic of being the abode of demons. Revelation chapter 11 and verse 7. It's talking about the two witnesses, I think. Yeah. "When they have finished their testimony, the beast that comes up out of the abyss will make war with them and overcome them and kill them." So remember, that beast came up from the bottomless pit or the abyss. And then Revelation 12. It's showing that this symbolism wasn't just in the Old Testament. It carried right on through. It was part of the worldview. Revelation 12, verse 3. "Another sign appeared in the heavens, and behold, a great red dragon having seven heads and ten horns. And on his head were seven diadems." He had crowns. So a dragon with seven heads. Did anybody think that dragon was real? No. But it was part of the culture. And it's part of our culture, because we see it in Revelation. You know, it's part of our culture, too. Chapter 13, first verse. "And the dragon stood on the sand of the seashore, and I saw a beast coming up out of the sea, having ten horns and seven heads. And on his horn were ten diadems, and on his heads were blasphemous names." So you have this multiple heads, multiple, you know, whatever it is, multiple kings, diadems, crowns, all this. It's all part of the same symbolism as it carries through the entire Bible. So let's summarize. I think the main point, you know, who am I? You come up with your own main points. I think the main point, the one point, is that God, the God we worship, is in control of everything. There's no category of chaos that's out here. It's like, God's in control of this, but not this out here, or not this over here. You read the other creation myths, you read read creation myths from Babylon, or you read the Ugaritic ones, which I haven't. I read the Babylonian ones, or parts of them. And the gods are reacting to the rest of the world. The gods are influencing the world that already exists. The gods are in control of certain things, but not other things. And the gods are fighting among themselves. The Bible makes it clear that the God we worship is in control of all that. He's created it all. He's in control of it. It was a time when it was all chaos. God put order to it. And now it's orderly, at least somewhat. At least the world might be in order. The people of the world, that's a different story. So that's, I think, the main point of it through the Bible. What can we get out of it? Well, I'd like to say, and I've already said it, but I'll say it again. Sometimes it seems like we're as good as dead. We're like Jonah. We're on our way down. It's bottomless. When you get to a certain point, though, there's no coming back. At least that's the way it seems. But God is in control of all that. And we can pray like Jonah. It's like, I'm down here, and I go much further. That's going to be it. I can't handle it anymore. And God lifts us out of the pit. Just like he lifted Jonah. Another thing that I, as I've gone through this and studied it myself, that is encouraging to me is the realization that whatever good, whatever the world has been able, whatever the world produces that's good. I'm talking about the earth and the whole thing. You know, God's responsible for that. But mankind, our species, has made a royal mess of it. And chaos, there's chaos all over the world. And that chaos is not God's fault. It's not God's doing. It's our doing and the devil's doing, using us. And so the world, apart from God, is chaos. And that's why it's so important to stay close to God. Because God has control of that. God can lift us out of it. But we have to be careful, as Christians, not to be part of it. It's very easy to just get wrapped up in it and fight for our own this, that, or the other, because we're human. But in doing that, we become part of the chaos. And God's called us out of that, out of chaos. And we also realize as we look through all this that in the biblical worldview, in the view of the world of the Bible, there is a spirit realm. And that spirit realm is not, well, there's an evil spirit realm as well as good. And the evil part of it, the evil part of the spirit realm doesn't care about you and me and what's good for us. And, they're fighting against God. And we don't want to cooperate with them. Although God, in the end, he has control of all that. In fact, the end is Revelation 21 and verse 1. And I would like you to turn there if you haven't been turning. Revelation 21 and verse 1. And people look at this and they think, is it literal? Is it not literal? I tend to think it's not literal at all for all kinds of reasons. But it's a wonderful verse when you put it together with everything that we've discussed already. Revelation 21, verse 1. I saw a new heaven and a new earth, for the first heaven and the first earth passed away, and there's no longer any sea. Now, I don't know what the new heaven and the new earth is going to be like in terms of, I don't think it'll be physical, so I don't know that it matters, what I think it's like. But this is saying something much bigger than that. What the actual, what it'll look like if we could see it or whatever. That's not the point of this verse, in my opinion. This verse is saying, when it's all said and done, when the Father turns everything over to the Son, there's no more sea. There's no more chaos. The world will be peaceful. Everyone will get along, whatever, however you picture that. No more chaos. In the new heaven and new earth, chaos will be ancient history. Until then, we need to stay close to our God, who is the source of stability and comfort in a chaotic world.